Today's gospel comes from the gospel of Matthew, beginning in the 16th chapter. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, but others Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. This is the gospel of our Lord today. You know, in our gospel story today, it kind of feels like Jesus is confronting his disciples with this final test or this final big question. Who do you say that I am? And it really has an emphasis on you. Who do you say that I am? The word can almost jump off the page as if Jesus is pointing a finger at you, staring into your eyes, deep into your heart and soul, and asking you, you, who do you say that I am? Every Saturday, though it's a bit difficult in COVID, my family and I, for years, have attended the Kenosha Harbor Market. And down at the Harbor Market is the same beautiful child of God holding the same sign that says, "Do you know what you have done to Jesus?" It's this implied message being that we've killed Jesus, and it's supposed to be this kind of this guilt into belief, this make you feel bad enough so that you would then profess Jesus so that you will not feel bad anymore. It's not really a theology or an understanding of church that I agree with, but it's one that is provocative. And I feel like sometimes this text can have the same effect. Who do you say that I am? It's kind of a scary question. I have to imagine in your life you have been confronted by somebody who had questions about your faith. Or perhaps they had questions about their faith that they wanted you to answer for them. Have you ever been asked to defend your faith? That's a really scary thing. And I don't know about you, but I start to sometimes, believe it or not, clam up. To hem and haw, for lack of a better word, to get a little anxious. I have all this knowledge and this degree from a seminary and years of church experience, but what if I don't give the perfect, authentic and right words to convince this person or to honor God enough? And I get anxious. I want these words to settle my own heart and convince this person that I'm right about the living God. But too often, if I'm honest, the words, they never come. Instead, I sit there either in an uncomfortable silence or I try too hard to say the right thing and I just stumble over words. I've heard some people say that Jesus is everything to me. Jesus is the one who guides my life. Jesus is the Son of God. Words that I'm not even sure I always believe or know what they mean. What does it mean to say that Jesus is the Son of God, but then able to say that Jesus is God? To someone who has never heard of Jesus or been raised in the church, this doesn't make any sense. And to be honest, some days it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me either. So after all of these encounters, I usually walk away feeling as if I just was inadequate, defeated, as if the person either challenging me or questioning me has either won or been let down by my response. I've given too many opportunities for holes to be poked into my faith. And then we go back to this gospel text. When Jesus first encounters the disciples and says, "Who do people say I am?" They say, "Well, Elijah, or hey, John the Baptist, or Jeremiah, or some other prophets." What Jesus was looking for. He seems to be disappointed in their response. There's this moment where he's both teacher, but also patient, friend, brother, father, parent, where he says, "No. But who do you say I am? What do you say I am?" There was no response from the disciples in that moment, I think, that would have been adequate in their minds. And it brings to mind a story Barbara Brown Taylor tells from a wonderful book she wrote called Seeds of Faith, Sermons from the Gospel of Matthew. And she tells a story about a woman outside of her church who had left church after a particularly rousing Sunday service and bumped into a thin, sort of lost-looking man who was standing on the sidewalk outside of the church, staring up at the cross that was on top of the church. And he looked this woman in the eyes and he pointed to the cross and he said these two words. He said, tell me. Tell me. And she looked at him and he says, tell me what it is that you believe in there. The woman said she began to answer him and then stopped and froze and ran through all these different responses and examples. She said, but she took so long that before she could utter one word, the young man said, never mind. I'm sorry if I bothered you, and walked away. Barbara Brown Taylor describes this lady as bothered indeed by the fact that she didn't know what to say. And as I put myself on the sidewalk out in front, if I'm honest, it bothers me too. I know the creeds of the church. I know all the things, I think. I know the words that we're supposed to say. I'm able to lead others. I believe in worship. I know the statement of this church, our mission statement, but accosted by someone to account for what we as church-going Christians believe in this building. How do we put that into words? How do we express our faith to someone who knows little or nothing about what happens in here and what our purpose is in the world? So when Jesus asks his disciples, who do you say that I am? I have to imagine the same uncomfortable silence, the same anxious glances, the same worry about the words that are going to be used. Maybe they look around wondering who's going to speak up. They're probably all secretly thinking it's going to be Peter because he tends to pipe up in these moments. And sure enough, out of the silence, Peter steps forward and calls Jesus the Messiah, the Son of the living God, which apparently is the right answer by Jesus's response. And an answer, in fact, that you and I as readers of Matthew's gospel already knew. We knew that. The very first sentence reads of this gospel, an account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. So we knew from the beginning of the gospel that's who Jesus was. But what does it mean to call Jesus the Messiah? Even though Jesus seems satisfied with Peter's response, Peter doesn't exactly know what it means to call Jesus the Messiah. As Messiah, we know now that Jesus is going to save the world, but it's going to be backwards. And what I mean is Jesus is going to do it in a way that nobody expects. See, Jesus is not the Messiah that Peter or the rest of the disciples or the Jews who were waiting for their Messiah expected him to be. When Peter makes this confession, Jesus has done nothing to look like that Messiah they thought was coming. The Messiah was not expected to be a healer or a person of wisdom. The Messiah was one who was going to come like a warrior with a sword, taking over all of the oppressive powers that are putting down the Jewish people. He was going to be the one who purifies, burning away the bad in the rotten parts of the world. But instead, Jesus comes as a peasant, not a warrior, as a person of peace, not a person of war. And instead of being the one who purifies and throws out that which is bad and unclean, he sits with the unclean and has a meal with the sinners and the tax collectors. He draws them near. He does not throw them out. And he certainly doesn't topple and destroy the oppressive powers of the day. Instead, he is the one who is destroyed, killed by a cross by the Roman regime. You see, perhaps Jesus knows that he is not the Messiah that Peter is expecting. In fact, a few verses later, Jesus is going to call Peter Satan. Jesus tells his disciples that he's going to die in Jerusalem. And Peter tries to tell Jesus, look, that's never going to happen. We got you. We're going to cover your back. Because remember, Peter thinks that Jesus is going to be the warrior Messiah. The one who comes to defeat, not to be defeated. Jesus is going to save the world, and it's right in front of the disciples' eyes, but it's all going to be backwards. Even though Jesus won't be the Messiah that Peter is expecting, even though Peter gets it right, but still sort of gets it wrong like he does almost all the time in the Gospels, Jesus still says to Peter, the one who will try to prevent him from being the kind of Messiah he must be, Peter, the one who will deny that he even knew Jesus three times before Jesus is crucified, to that Peter, Jesus says these words, blessed are you, Simon. You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. Here's a quick Greek lesson for you today. When Jesus says this, there's this play on words that's happening there. The Greek word for Peter is Petros. And it means stone or pebble. It's a smaller piece of a large rock. And the Greek word for rock, the whole rock, is Petra, which means a boulder or a great big rock. So Jesus says to Peter, I'm going to build my church on you, Petra, but you will just be one piece of a larger foundation for my church, that larger rock. So Petros and Petra, all coming together as this foundational piece, but not alone. Peter may be this small piece of this larger rock, but that rock will build up over time into eternity to be the solid foundation that Jesus knew would be created in his church. And so it is for us. Jesus is saving the world today. Jesus continues to save the world today, but it's backwards. Jesus is still building the church, and Jesus is doing so on the backs of people like you and I, people who stumble almost every day sometimes to answer the question, who do you say that I am? People who clam up and go silent when confronted with questions about our faith. And the beautiful part about being a smaller part of a larger foundation is that everything you do matters to God, but also the future of God's church doesn't rest completely on your shoulders. We go through this together, helping each other out along the way. For many years before LCI, I worked as a youth and family minister in Kenosha, and there was a young gentleman, I'll use his first name, Matt, who came to our group, and we had a very large youth program at the time, and we would begin, it was like a service almost, a worship service. We would begin with song and prayer, and then there would be some games, but then we would go into a time of teaching, and we would end with some prayer and worship, and we didn't know Matt's story, but Matt came in, and Matt had come from an abused home. Matt had come from a place of unsafety. In fact, Matt, emancipated himself at the age of 17 legally, because his home was so destructive. And Matt came in because he was invited by a friend, and he tells me afterwards that he spent a lot of the time there not believing a word that was said, not understanding anything. He sat there in grief, trying to believe in this God that everybody seemed to be believing in and singing about and praying to. But he wondered, how can I believe any of this? How can I believe that God has defeated death when the very people created to protect me have put me in so many situations that could have caused my death? He said it was about halfway through our youth service that he realized he didn't have to believe in Jesus today. In the presence of grief, pain, and the absence of belief, he realized that he had this whole community of people standing around him who would believe on his behalf. See, sometimes the church is like that. Sometimes it is hard to say who you are, Jesus. Yet we have the church around us to lift us up and say, we will help you point to Jesus. We will help you to believe in Jesus. And we will help you in the midst of belief or in the absence of belief to be reminded that you are not alone, that we are but a part of this together. God is building God's church on your shoulders, on all of your shoulders, mine included, but the whole weight of the church does not rest on your shoulders. We do this together, friends, now more than ever. And my final plea to you, as a beautiful congregation that I have been so fortunate to work with, to serve, I say, think about your role in the kingdom of heaven. Think about what you've been called and created to do in this world. You are part of something much bigger. And if we are able to, like Peter, name that Jesus is the Messiah and allow that to affect our lives, then we can bring joy and love to a joyless and loveless world. But we do it together. Don't be overwhelmed by fear. Push in and lean into this community. Rely on it so that in those moments of unbelief, we can believe for you. Amen.